This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, thanks very much for downloading this podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. We build this podcast from a live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland called Out of Doors, which this week was pretty rich and varied. This is what we're going up to. You know, there isn't a cloud in the sky. You still see the moon above the houses there. And right in the centre of the car park here in BBC Aberdeen, there is a magnificent copper beech tree, and the sun has just risen in the east, and it's just touching the top anymore. It's as if it's caught fire. Beautiful. I'm Mark Stephen. With me, 40 miles to the north, Mr. Ewan McElraith.
Yeah, sun's just coming up here as well. The clouds are breaking up. And there's a roe deer walking. The barley got finished last night.
Oh, good.
There's a roe deer walking down the rows of straw. Say, where's all the barley gone? It's a lovely sight. We're always keen to hear your stories. Tell us what you're up to. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. The text number is 80295. Tweet at BBC Outofdoors. It goes on and on. There's Facebook. You can call as well. 0808 592 95 00. Have a wee chat with Lewis. Tell us what you're doing.
Last week we were trying to avoid the A word, but I think we just have to embrace it now. It does definitely feel like autumn. You know, there's been colder nights, and I think the trees are definitely changing colour now.
Well, I'm looking at a whole row of beech trees in front of me, and it's quite interesting because about 30% of them have got a definite yellow tinge, a couple hanging on there. The swallows, I keep on looking every morning to see if there's swallows. There's still one or two hanging on, but it's definitely autumnal. But that's great, you know, the apples are on the trees, crisp walks and loads of stubble fields to play in.
Yeah, no, I was watching the swallows the other day and just, you know, they're all lined up on the wires, thinking, you treacherous little swine, they'll be gone in a minute. Anyway, coming up, the hundreds of miles of hidden paths around Scotland. We've got a walk around Glasgow's Rjukan Glen, where we'll be talking about beavers and orcas.
And over the last few months, we've brought you a range of sounds, from the ever-popular mystery bird, yes it is, to wasps eating chairs, to rivers, wind, the list goes on. And we're really delighted that some of you are getting in on the act as well. Walter Jameson got in touch.
Yeah, I love this. Walter says, "Dear Out of Doors, please find attached a short audio file of a vole I managed to get in the garden of a house in Glenprozen. My wife Paul and I always listen into Out of Doors on Saturday mornings and very much enjoy the programme. We always know the weekend has started when we wake up to your voices rather than the GMS team."
Well, at least we serve some useful function in life. Slightly. Here's Walter's recording. Now, it's short, but I've put it on a bit of a loop and it is delightful.
Can I just say how proud I am to work for a programme where people send us in recordings of voles? It must be unique.
I mean, it doesn't get any more rock and roll than that.
I mean,
it's just wonderful. And it goes on, and then we've got a bit of a challenge, big challenge. Joe Gow wanted our help. "Please help identify this bird call, heard frequently during April and May in the Comley Bank area of Edinburgh and along the Water of Leith. I've never caught sight of the culprit and unable to find the call after trying various websites." Here's Joe's recording.
Quite obviously, it's an Edinburgh parrot.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a wee go at it, and I think I've narrowed it down, but I'm prepared to be wrong. And if I am wrong, give us a call, 0808 592 95 00. First guesses were a tree pipit and a yellow wagtail, but this is what I think it is. It's a willow warbler.
Is that not just the same recording?
No, it's definitely different. I waded through hours and hours. Rather tedious bird calls to get that. As I say, I'm reasonably confident, but if you know better, I'm prepared to be corrected, because proper ornithologists out there, give us a call.
So I'd like to extend my personal thanks to Joe Gow for inflicting hours and hours of tedium on Mr. McElwraith. It's good for him, it's character building. The rising temperatures of Scotland's rivers is causing concern for folk involved in conservation and angling. Now, one way of reducing the temperature, believe it or not, is actually planting trees.
Yeah, well, it's not that strange, because it shades the river, but the Fisheries Management Scotland is calling for urgent action by the Scottish Government to reform its tree planting grants so that more trees can be planted purely for conservation.
Helen Needham, an old friend of ours, used to be the editor of the newsroom up here. He's now chair of the River Dee Trust, Sandy Bremner. And she met him, literally, in the middle of the river near her home in Aberdeenshire.
What does a good Dee salmon look like?
Oh, it's a beautiful silvery torpedo of a fish with a relatively small head and a big muscular body. It's travelled across the oceans to feed, and it's come back filled with energy, ready to power up through the current to forge up waterfalls. It's a beautiful thing. Salmon is a forest species. We as humans have done our best to get rid of forests over the years. Over 2,000 years, most of the trees have gone from the Upper Dee. On top of all the threats facing salmon at sea, and they're substantial, there's a significant developing threat to salmon on the Dee and in rivers across Scotland. And that, again, is rooted in climate change. Young salmon, salmon par, start to suffer thermal stress when water temperature reaches 23 degrees centigrade. What does that mean? It means that the little fish stop feeding, they become vulnerable to predators, they catch diseases at 23 degrees. 2 years ago on the Dee, we recorded temperatures upwards of 27 degrees, and we know that fish die at 33 degrees. So the one thing we do know is that there's going to be more dramatic changes in our climate. There are going to be higher temperatures. So what we have to do as custodians of the river is to plant trees, restore the river to the tree-lined habitat it used to be, providing shade to cool the river, to safeguard the fish, to add nutrients, little insects and vertebrates, to kick-start an ecosystem that's been denuded over the years. So we have an obligation to do that, but time isn't on our side. We've seen damaging temperatures already. We're expecting more. We need to get a million trees onto the banks of the Upper Dee over the next 15 years.
You are the chair of the River Dee Trust, which is a conservation charity, really. And this week you've been upping the game and the pressure, really, on the government to commit to planting more trees.
Yeah, it's ourselves, other trusts, other conservation charities across Scotland, led by Fisheries Management Scotland, our representative body. We're basically saying there's a threat to salmon. There's a new and developing threat that we know about, that government scientists are warning about. There are some grants that we can access, but they're weighted against conservation planting on rivers. They assume that the trees that we plant will be harvested. These trees won't be harvested. They're there for life. They're there to die in time, to rot, to create shelter for the fish, for other small species, and to enrich the ecosystem.
And the trees, they obviously have a massively positive impact on the health of the river. Is a lot of it to do with providing shade to provide areas which are not as warm for the fish then?
Yes, the trees provide shade which cools the river. We need cool rivers. Salmon's a forest species. it's also a cold water species. We're experiencing rising temperatures, and we're being told by most scientists that these temperatures will carry on increasing. We have an opportunity to do something about it. We've got an obligation to do something about it. So, yes, we cool the rivers, and we help all wildlife in the process. We're restoring habitat that's been lost over millennia.
I know from personal experience of living here is the muckle spate that happened a few years ago. Devastating impact all along the Dee Valley, but I would assume that planting trees higher up the Dee Valley would have a positive effect on the water levels should there be a huge flood again too.
Yes, trees mitigate against flooding. They won't stop it. There'll still be spates. There'll still be damaging spates. But trees are just part of the natural cycle, and everything benefits and everybody benefits. They slow runoff. They enrich the habitat. They help salmon. They help freshwater pearl mussels. They help people. And they are an essential part of Scotland's green recovery. We have an obligation to do what we can, and the government has an obligation to do what it can to preserve species and a heritage that is at the moment under threat, and that threat is growing. The government's own science points in that direction. Now is the time to act.
So really what you're asking for is that there is support for planting purely for conservation reasons, and that there isn't this caveat about commercial forestry.
Marine Scotland scientists have expertly mapped out every river in Scotland, pointed to the areas which are vulnerable. We know where these are. We know that something can be done about it. By tweaking the existing grant system so that conservation planting isn't penalised because we fail to harvest the trees, that is just good common sense. It's good stewardship of a natural environment.
Sandy Brimley, our chair of the River Dee Trust. And it's not just the Dee that's involved in this campaign, it's rivers all over Scotland.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic because, as Sandy was saying there, our salmon rivers have been brutalised over the years. Trees have been taken away, the banks have been, you know, where they might have eroded in the past, they moved, they've been straightened and protected. A lot of our salmon rivers are heavily managed artificial places, and putting trees back in it might just be the start of that process. And I love the bit about, I never even thought about it, salmon are forest fish.
I've never heard that phrase before too. It was a real attention grabber for me.
Yep. Anyway, moving seamlessly on to the official mystery bird for this week, which was prompted by listeners Lorna Stewart and Harvey Kay in Wisconsin. They say, "Greetings from the Badger State. We've listened to your podcast for years and enjoyed the mystery sounds. Here's one for you from our morning walk in Green Bay, Wisconsin. We're used to the Canadian geese, the egrets and white pelicans that spend the summer here, and I've seen these mystery birds before, but this was special. Here's what they sent us.
That's a fantastic
sound. So what are these birds? They're fantastic. They're found the world over, fascinating to watch, and they've recently been successfully breeding in Scotland. And here's what the European version sounds like. And if you've got any ideas on that, have a go just now. You can get in touch. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295. You can tweet at BBC Outdoors or give Lewis a call. He's on 08 085 92 95 00.
I had no idea that Wisconsin was the Badger State. That's brilliant.
No, it's not been a wasted day at all. You know, we've learned so much. Dinner parties across Scotland. Well, did you know the Badger State?
Really? Really? Well, why is everyone sitting away from me? Anyway, we were talking about autumn earlier. We are still desperately clinging on to the last vestiges of summer, but there are things to look forward to about the changing seasons.
And you're getting all excited about geese with folk singer Karine Polwart.
I live on what's known as the Buchan Plain, so, you know, if I get out the house and climb the hill slightly and look north, there's about 30, 40 miles of just more or less flat land coming down from the Grampians, which is just scoured flat by the glaciers. So if you stand on the hill when the geese are returning, you just get V after V after V of birds coming in. To me, it's one of the sort of key turning points of the year.
One of the key features of Fala Moor is that 2% of the world's population of pink-footed geese come to overwinter on the moor. And I totally agree with you. For me, the point in autumn when you hear the first skein flying over, I get a little wee chill up my back every time that happens. And from Fala Moor, you get this amazing vista of the Forth Valley. So it's the same kind of feeling of V after V of geese coming in to rest either at Fala or over at Aberlady or at Gladhouse Reservoir further into Mid Lothian. So there's these resting spots right across Lothian for the geese. And the geese that come here, the same ones that come by you, they come from Iceland and Greenland. I was fascinated by that journey and fascinated by the place names that the geese would follow on their journey to get to this point. So that's built into this little piece. And to me, the thing about the goose skein is that the formation, the V formation that we know, is aerodynamically an incredible evolved mechanism, because each of the geese, in the way that they fly with their wings outstretched, they break the wind for the geese in behind. So they literally create these pockets of wind resistance for the geese in behind them. And they shift constantly. One leads and then falls back and another leads. And this whole idea that no single goose is responsible for the well-being of all the geese, they act together as a unit. It just seemed to me like a beautiful metaphor for the best of human endeavours. And for me, the best of human endeavour is universal healthcare. So that's explicitly referenced in this piece.
Every goose takes a turn. Stepping up, falling back, labouring and resting. Stepping up, falling back, labouring and resting. Like sky-born socialists, no lone bird bears the brunt. Holding on, holding on. It's a gorgeous symbol.
I love the fact that you've used so much rich sound effect within that, and particularly the sound of the beating wing. Did you actually capture that? How did you get that sound?
The sound whiz in the team is Pippa Murphy rather than myself. Most of the sound for the album in the theatre was gathered from the moor. So there are other birds in the sound piece. So for example, the larks and the red grouse and the plovers and curlews, and all of these sounds are gathered from the moor. But the geese, I confess, they were not gathered by us. They were sourced from other sound archives. We couldn't quite afford the kind of flying sound set up for our wee theatre piece for Edinburgh. Maybe next time. Yeah, we hide in the big guns.
There's a musicality in that sound itself, the rhythm there of the beating. Do you draw on that sense of musicality from the sounds of bird songs and the sounds of the natural world around you in your songwriting?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think what I draw on perhaps is the feeling that I get from the sound, maybe rather than the sound itself. I draw, I guess, on the dynamic swoop that you get, because that's one of the big things for me about the geese. When they take off, From the moor, if you're lying in the heather as they take off, it's the most incredible feeling having that wash over you. So I've loved the collaborative process, actually, of working with Pippa, because her kind of art and craft background is quite different from mine. So she's trained in sound design, but also in classical composition. So she's working with much, much bigger sound palettes than I am as a folk musician. And what I've loved is the way that we've brought our two different kind of crafts together in making the work about Fala. And she is able to conjure some of that sense of swoop and wash and feeling, which I can do better, to be honest, with words than with sound.
Paul worked there on music from her album A Pocket of Wind Resistance, and you can hear more of Emma. We'd have a fascinating chat with her on the latest edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast, available in the podcast section of the Out of Doors page of the BBC Radio Scotland website. I mean, to be honest, there was so much information in it, we've ended up publishing that podcast in two sections, and we'll bring you part two next week. Coming up, we've got a couple of opportunities for you to get involved in some wildlife spotting.
Yeah, and we've also got the mystery bird. Disappointingly, Trish in Edinburgh has already got it right.
No.
So failed even before the 7 o'clock news. Have a listen to this, see if you can figure out what it is. It's a really haunting call. If you know what that is, are we ready for clues yet or not?
Yeah, go on, give him one.
Well, you had a good one. Anyway, Lewis is back at base. He's on 0885 92 95 00.
Right, this is a cryptic clue to the mystery bird this week. It's an uplifting sound, that. Now, a year-long project by Rambler Scotland has discovered there may be hundreds of miles of hidden paths across the country. Joining us more to tell us, he's Director of Communications at Rambler Scotland, Brendan Paddy. Good morning, Brendan. How are you doing?
Good morning. Very well.
Excellent. I actually saw your wee video about this on Twitter. These paths are essentially paths that don't appear on any maps.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So because there is no definitive map of the paths in Scotland, it's a bit hit and miss whether paths are actually there on the map, even if they're well marked on the ground and well used. And that makes it really hard for people who may have got really into walking, for example, during lockdown and want to explore a bit further, because you can't just pick up a map and get a good sense of what the local path network's going to be like.
But that has come to a real surprise, both to Mark and I. You know, we've got world-class access rates. Why are we not better at mapping paths?
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? Because, as you say, the access rights are absolutely world-class. And for many of us, that's good enough because, you know, we're quite happy to grab our map, to work out a route, to read the landscape and head for the hills. But what we believe at Rambler Scotland is that, you know, walking can be brilliant for absolutely everybody. And that includes people who are just walking in their local area, as well as people heading for the hills and, you know, maybe have a little bit less experience. And, of course, you know, we're not saying that you shouldn't be well-prepared and to have the skills for the things you're going to do. If you're heading, you know, for the Kinghorn Plateau in winter, you need to have the navigation to go with that. But there's lots of things that you can do at much lower level that are brilliant for you and brilliant for all of us in terms of the nation's health. But at the moment, it's just that little bit harder than it should be.
Yeah, but it's a bit strange, isn't it? We're encouraging the nation to get out walking, and you need local knowledge to have these secret paths. I mean, like, I wouldn't know where these paths are in some areas.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And I mean, you know, I can take an example on my own doorstep. You know, I moved up to Scotland 4 years ago now, and I've got the Pentland Hills just south of the city in Edinburgh. And what I found exploring there and using EOS maps, which I'm used to doing, is there's really good paths there, you know, well-marked paths, well-kept paths in some cases, as well as the usual sheep tracks. Now, we're not expecting OS or anyone else to put the sheep tracks on the map, but, you know, if something is a made path, if something is well-used, if it's a very well-established design line and it's not going anywhere, it makes sense to let people know about that. And so what we found was, when we started this project in the trial area, which is in the west of the Central Belt, was we reckon only about half the piles that are there on the ground are actually on the map. And they're a mixed bag. I mean, wow. I'm not going to say for a minute that they're all beautiful things of great beauty. And the next thing we want to do is get a few folk on board to actually walk them on the ground and actually make sure that they're in a decent state, and we have some idea about the surfaces and things like that.
I don't know if you saw the exchange, Brendan, between Ordnance Survey and Bob Reid, formerly of the Mountaineering Council of Scotland. But Bob had said to them, look, any chance of getting the sort of the core path network up on Ordnance Survey maps and things. Now, again, just to my interpretation of the response from our Ordnance Survey, they seem to have technical definitions for things, which probably means, the path's got to be 2 metres wide and blah, 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 and built of such and such, and then they can put it on a map. Some of these things don't fit their categories.
Yeah, I think there is an issue with the definition of paths, and also having spoken to Ordnance Survey, they have some reservations about where there are issues regarding legal status. And I think, in all honesty, they love the situation south of the border where, frankly, you don't tend to have paths that are worth putting on a map unless they're rights of way. But clearly in Scotland, the world's a little bit more complicated than that. But we don't think it's beyond the wit of man to actually resolve problems like that. And a big chunk of the project is to say, okay, so for the map we're going to create and make public for everybody, whether it's Ordnance Survey or just somebody who wants to get out their front door and walk in their local area, we want to make sure that we've got a clear definition of what's a path, and it isn't going to include the goat tracks, but it should include, for example, the core path network. And at the moment, you can find chunks of the core path network which are well worth having, which are good paths, which aren't on the Ordnance Survey map. So it isn't simply a question of the paths not meeting their quality standards. There is, unfortunately, quite a big gap there for a variety of reasons.
I read this with absolute disbelief that there could be as many as 50% more that aren't even on the maps. Now, you had a particular area for the project. You must be planning to expand it, surely.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we found in part of the trial area in western Bartonshire, we found 300 miles of paths that looked like they were going to be worth exploring further, and only half of those were on the maps that most walkers would be using. But, that is just the trial area. What we need to do now, and it's a challenge, we had 14 fantastic partners, including councils and charities and government bodies, help us by sharing their data, and we now need to scale that up right across Scotland. And when we've done that, we want to make that mapping data free for everybody. And, we need to make sure it's decent quality, that it reflects the reality on the ground. And we want that to be useful both to people getting out walking or doing other things in the outdoors, but also to people who are creating maps, because part of this issue is the data isn't there, it's not in one place, and it's not a consistent quality. And we want to start trying to crack that nut.
Brendan, I suppose it doesn't really need to be the Ordnance Survey who does this job. Somebody else could take it on and say, right, this is what we've got in Scotland.
Yeah, exactly. And, we'd love to work with Ordnance Survey on this, and we have reached out to them and spoken to them about it. They've foreseen some difficulties, as you flagged. But, for example, Nature Scott went ahead and produced a single map of all the core paths, which you can now find on their website, and that's on OpenStreetMap. So there are other solutions. But from our point of view, we're agnostic about that in a sense. We don't mind who we work with. We want this to be available to everybody. The critical bit for us is, if you want to go walking, you need to be able to find out in the paths in your local area. I mean, when we surveyed people in Scotland about why they didn't walk more, three quarters of them said to us, we're not sure where we can walk, and particularly, we're not sure where we can find paths that we want to walk on.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's fascinating. Brendan, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Right. Interesting to see who could actually pick that up, though, Ewan. Who could take that responsibility on,
Scottish Natural Heritage or Nature Scott, whatever they're called, or a collaboration with the Ramblers. There's so many different groups out there. The other thing that would worry me slightly is there's probably a lot of folks saying, I don't want to tell the rest of the world. I've got my favourite little walk, yeah, and I don't want it on a map. I want to keep it to myself.
It's mine.
But interesting project, though. It's mine. I'm not telling anybody.
Get off. Got some comments coming in. Brian, also known as Somewhat Al Dente, I love that, says, awake far too early today, but it means I'm tuned into BBC Out of Doors, which is always a joy. Definitely turning autumnal in Strontian 2, folks. That's true. And Geraldine says, good morning, boys. bless. I'll not be out of doors today as I'm in Edinburgh Royal Infirmary waiting for an op on Monday. Love the programme. It's always such a welcome start to the weekend. Heard a fox barking during the night. Not a sound I would normally hear at home in rural Angus. Best of luck with the op, Geraldine. And thank you very much for getting in contact. Coming up, keep your eyes peeled for any beavers. We go for a walk in Glasgow's Rookin Glen. And how are you faring with this week's mystery bird? Have a listen. This isn't a lone example this time. Here they are en masse. See, that's fantastic.
Few folk beginning to get this right now. It's just brilliant. That bugling is wonderful. I was going to give a clue, but I'm not prepared to stick my neck out on that one.
No.
Duncan in Nairn said he got it right. Mary McIntyre got it right. Marjorie Bickett got it right. So it's obviously not as hard as I thought it was going to be.
Well, having said that, Colin and Mary Abercrombie and Andrew McLaren and Hoy both thought it was a grey heron, which is close but not quite right. Ronnie Fraser thought it was a grey egret. Again, close but not quite right. Yeah, not too bad at all.
Yeah, better than usual. If you do know, give Lewis a ring because he's absolutely swamped and he'll welcome much more calls. 0808 592 9500 or you can text us 80295.
If you are active on social media, or even if you just use social media, you don't have to be active on social media to use it, you may have come across some recent amazing video of orca up in Shetland.
Yeah, it's part of being what's described by the coordinator of the Orca Project in Shetland Wildlife, Hugh Harrop, who's done many stuff in the past. He's described it as the greatest citizen science event in the world. Hugh's an old friend of the programme, and I caught up with him via Zoom to hear more and to get ever so slightly jealous, as I have yet to see an orca. So how easy are they to spot?
Harder than most people think. I think this is one of the problems of social media, that you know, you're out and about and you're lucky enough to encounter a pod of orca, and social media being social media, it goes live to the world literally within seconds. But they are tricky to see in Scottish waters, but there are regular sights, and some places are indeed better than others.
But you've had great success with it this season. I mean, why is that?
We've started seeing good numbers of orcas and encountering pods regularly, really for the last sort of 4 or 5 years. And that is really down to a social media Facebook group platform that we set up back in 2016 to try and engage the public and try and have them help us with regards to when they were seeing orcas. We could also do likewise and reciprocate that. So, you know, here in Shetland, where you've got a population of 23,000 people, an awful lot of which are on the Facebook group, whether it's a postman, a coast guard, somebody out, you know, delivering for one of the supermarkets and they're passing the coastal bays. You know Shetland, you're familiar with it, and therefore you're never that far away from the sea. And the orcas here hunt so close inshore that, you know, they are seen regularly and ultimately reported regularly.
Why are they so special to people? What is the magic about killer whales, orca, for people?
I think like most whales and dolphins, cetaceans, there's enigmas attached to them. We know very little about their lives. They live in the water. We only see them above the water for a few seconds of an encounter before they go down, before seeing them again. They're apex predators, and whether it's bears, sharks, orcas, I think there's always that enigma attached to to apex predators like orca.
As I've said before, you've had amazing success, and so have others, in seeing orca this summer. How does it compare to previous years?
Well, this summer hasn't been what we would call a vintage summer, but we're only going on about 4 or 5 years. The interesting thing about that is, with the social media platform that I mentioned earlier, we've got sort of replicated sites down in Orkney and along the Caithness coast and over in the Western Isles. And, you know, the orcas that we see here in Shetland are mobile. We would see one pod in Shetland, and a few days later, through photo identification, we would pick up that pod. Recorded by others, say in Orkney, and then onwards, etc. So what is interesting this year is we had a spike of sightings in about April or May, which obviously in the middle of lockdown, none of us could really get to. We had a good run at the end of July, and then since then, yeah, literally only two or three possible encounters. But one of the pods that we know so well here, a pod that we call the 27th pod, was actually filmed off the Faroe Islands back in mid-August. So we see this disappearance, if you like, of orcas from Shetland waters, but then a reappearance of them elsewhere around North Atlantic archipelagos.
What have you learned about the orca over the years? Has there been an increase in knowledge, their habitat, their behaviour?
One thing we have learned through citizens' science project of what this is and through people taking photographs of them, we've learned a lot about the family histories of orcas and indeed how many pods are visiting our shores. Back in 2008-2009, there was a study done by University of Bangor by a colleague of ours called Dr. Andy Foote. And Andy was very much the instrumental in documenting all the orcas, not just around Shetland, but obviously in Scotland. That formed the foundation of something that we know as the Scottish Orca ID Catalogue. What we thought when we set up the 2016 social media group and all of a sudden we were flooded with more encounters and more sightings than we'd ever really known was we suspected that there would be more pods than there actually were. The complete opposite happened. We were seeing the same pods, but ultimately on a more regular basis because they were seen more regularly. But what that has done is allowed us to take more photographs for photo ID. Orcas are unique with their dorsal fin shape and any nicks and chunks out of those, the most famous being John Coe out on the West Coast, and also the scarring on the saddles. So we're certainly seeing more encounters of the same animals. But what that does allow us to do is to build up a sort of family profile of the animals that we are seeing. So, for instance, I mentioned earlier the 27th pod. We name each pod after the presumed matriarch of each pod. In this case, it's animal number 27 from the Scottish Orca ID catalogue. Now, the 27s we first photographed back in 2006. They were a pod of four. They're now a pod of eight. And in that 14-year period, we've documented at least three calves and one animal, which is unknown, may have left the pod and rejoined. So with the six or seven pods that we are regularly encountering inshore, close inshore in Shetland waters, we are certainly documenting them, substantially from a photo ID point of view, and we are learning more about the sort of lifestyles and indeed the family history of them.
You got some brilliant footage, of which I am really envious. But it's not just you, there's been loads of folk out filming.
We're blessed really to have so many keen folk and so many, sharp pairs of eyes with regards to when there are orcas around, updating social media and ourselves and indeed others as to where. And yeah, it's very much a sort of community-based and community-spirited place. And we want people to get out and enjoy them, and we want people to share their photographs with us. We are not the only ones capable of doing this. Some of the views that we get, let's not forget that something I think, you'll notice in the drone footage is just how close these animals are hunting inshore. Their typical prey item when they're doing that is common and harbour seals and grey seals. So some of the views, to get an orca, a 25-foot bull orca past you, literally a couple of metres away, words can't really describe, but it's exciting. Because, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the sort of what we've done here has been replicated by colleagues in Orkney and Caithness, and we've built this sort of pseudo Scottish orca community, which is positive, and just one of the, I think personally, one of the most successful citizen science projects there's been nationwide.
Hugh Harrop there, and you'll find the videos of those orcas on Hugh's Shetland Wildlife Facebook page. I've never seen them in the wild either. You nearly saw them. You missed them by about an hour, half an hour?
Yeah, it was about an hour. Just so frustrating, but it's absolutely well worthwhile going on to Hugh's page because they're, they're right below you. It's stunning to actually think we can see that in our waters, and you'll see more of that in the new series of Landward, which was coming up. Hugh posted some amazing photographs yesterday, as did Charlie Phillips in The Black Isle. He's got some stunning photographs of young dolphins as well. And Drew H has cracked the way to get a mention on any radio programme throughout the world. He starts, "Great show." That's all you need to say. Listening to the show, driving north on the A82 heading home to Noidart. The bracken is turning, the autumn colours are on the oaks. The journey takes 5 hours. It's quicker than going to New York. But Noidart, as we all agree, is better. He reckons it sounds like a heron or a northern diver.
Ah, well, Donald and Fry reckons it's a whooper swan. Gary for Pennycook says, is it a stork? Susie from Spot, I no idea where Spot is. Red Kite.
Spot is East Lothian, near kind of almost kind of Innerwick kind of territory, yeah.
Okay.
Beautiful wee village.
Fiona in Pool Youth says, is it a stork? And this is actually quite heart-rending. Connor Walsh says, I first recorded birdsong when I was a kid. I've had all the expensive equipment for 10 years. I work in a bird-heavy conservation organisation, and I am terrible at identifying birds by their call. BBC Outdoors has a mystery bird every morning, and I rarely know it. Well, join the rest of the queue, Connor. You've got nothing but sympathy from me. Now, our outdoor exercise piece this week comes from an occasional member of our team, Jim Moatoni. Jim shares his favourite lockdown walk with us, and it's around Glasgow's Rookin Glen, which is a green space which was crowned the UK's favourite park in 2016. Accompanying him here is his wife Paula and their little Lakeland Terrier.
Fudge!
Fudge!
Come on, good girl, this way. Good girl.
Up we come now here to the boating point. We need to put the dog in the lead here because... there's lots of ducks and other swans. Let's see exactly what's here that we can see. We have moorhens. They are in the park all year round. They love to coot. You maybe hear them there. They have swans. We've got mallards here as well. Regulars at Rookin Glen, they're lovely colours, they're green heads. And we have coots and tufted ducks here. So let's go round this way, Mrs. Matuni. And now here we come to this lovely waterfall. So this kind of is us getting towards the kind of glen walk park of this park. Power of water always amazes me. So this is us now, yeah, descending into the Glen Walks. Glen Walks are paths that kind of run along both sides of the Old House Burn. They run right the way through the park to the ponds where we're at. The thing about the walk that's really interesting is it follows the path of the natural gorge and it showcases a lot of the park's important geological features and the kind of remnants of the industrial heritage. You can also see traces of ancient woodland in the oak trees that are here, but also non-native species like Douglas fir, which kind of evidence the designed nature of this landscape and, you know, contribute to the gorgeous variety of the trees that are present here. But I love this because once you come in here, it's like you're away from the city. It's a plain walk. It feels like you're in the middle of the countryside. I'm often in this park at 6:30 in the morning, and for a while I was a little freaked out after seeing the thing that happened to the Blackbird Watcher in New York Central Park, the woman calling the police, black man attacking her in the park at the start of all this Black Lives Matter stuff. And yeah, sometimes just giving yourself a shake to think, God, what could happen? Being here on my own, is it something that someone could accuse me of doing something just racism? I don't know, could it happen in Glasgow? Could it happen in Scotland? Of course it could. Hasn't happened yet. Let's go down this way. But it does put me in mind of the whole idea of Scotland, race, identity for me as a black male. as an Afro-Region. I call myself an Afro-Region. Born in Lagos, Nigeria, but brought up in Glasgow. Fiercely proud of it, my, I suppose, dual heritage. But that kind of forgotten history about Scotland, its links to the slave trade, which I suppose is coming to the fore with all of that Black Lives Matter stuff. And it puts me in mind of, oh, it's a bit mucky here, puts me in mind of the Robert Burns poem, A Slave's Lament. The interesting thing is that anyone in 18th century Scotland who really wanted to improve himself thought nothing of going to Jamaica and working in that vile, vile trade. Slavery. Where black lives didn't matter. It was in sweet Senegal that my foes did me enthrall, for the lands of Virginia, Virginia, oh, torn from that lovely shore, and must never see it more. And alas, I am weary, weary, oh, torn from that lovely shore, and must never see it more. And alas, I am weary, weary, oh, oh my goodness. All on that charming coast is no bitter snow and frost like the lands of Virginia, Virginia, oh. And there streams forever flow, and there flowers forever blow. And alas, I am weary, weary, oh. The burden I must bear, while the cruel scourge I fear in the lands of Virginia, Virginia, oh. And I think on friends most dear with the bitter, bitter tear. And alas, I am weary, weary, oh. And I think on friends most dear with the bitter, bitter tear. And alas, I am weary, weary, oh. Slave's Lament, Robert Burns. It's incredible to think that a man like Burns, our bard, could write a poem like that, lamenting about the fate of a slave. But he himself was heading out to Jamaica to work in the plantations as an overseer, like lots of Scots that were trying to improve themselves. And it was only because his book of poems was published and he made some cash from it that he didn't go. Incredible. Shall we go? So that's us back out of the glen.
Come on then.
I love this park. I hope you've enjoyed my wee tour around it. And as I say, it's a great thing, a great reset. 45 minutes. Feel like you've been in the forest. You can do it at lunch. There have been times where I've done it twice in a day, but usually for me it's the great way to start the day.
Jim, wife Paula, and Fudge of the Lakeland Terrier in Rookin Glen. It's a fantastic location.
Evie Pride got in touch and she says, "Autumn, morning boys." Autumn is definitely here in West Argyll. I'm in Strachur between Loch Fyne and the stunning fresh waters of Loch Eck. Walked through Benmore Gardens yesterday with my dog Freya, and the touches of colour change were all around subtle, but it's the cooler mornings in the air and clearer skies. Love the programme and all the cheery banter. Makes waking up early on a Saturday morning worthwhile. Well, I'm glad it's worthwhile for you.
See, it's interesting. It's not the colours that indicate it to me. You know, there's a morning every year where you step outside and it's just there's just something about the nature of the air. It's slightly colder, but it's fresher, it's crisper, and you think, all right, okay, fair enough. We're on the cusp here. Helen says, great.
An extra layer of clothing, yeah.
Yeah, at least one. Helen says, great to hear Brendan Paddy of Rambler Scotland talking about Scotland's Hidden Path Network at BBC Outdoors, an exciting project with so much potential to help more people enjoy the outdoors. However, Scott, brackets reprieve soul, Edinburgh, says, the joy of local walking is exploring uncertainty, achievement and safety. Map a path and bikes will be on it, destroying its surface, accelerating erosion and spoiling the walk. Other views may be available. Rob Fowler says, I park my car under a tree in winter. It keeps the frost off, no scraping involved. In summertime, the sun is overhead and is shining directly down. And finally, Keith Dolan says, morning, gents. I hope all is well. Up early for a walk and the world seems prevalent. The A word seems prevalent this morning. Back in now, having a cup of Lapsang Souchong tea, which the aroma could have me sitting there next to the fire in the car park. I'm not up on bird calls, but I thought I'd have a guess. Is it a red-throated diver? No, Keith, it isn't, but it's a good guess. Keep up the great work, he says. Anyway, I'm quoting here. The worldwide efforts to combat critical levels of biodiversity loss will fail without far greater involvement from local communities. That's something from the Edinburgh Declaration. It's an international document that was published on Monday. Professor Des Thompson is Principal Science Advisor at Nature Scot, which contributed to the declaration, and he joins us now to tell us more. Good morning, Des.
Morning. Great to hear from you both. How are you both?
Very well, thank you. Very well. Oh. Nice to hear from you too. Now, we were actually supposed to join you back in March to mark the opening of negotiations on that declaration. Obviously, that didn't happen. So how did this all come together during lockdown?
Oh, well, we were indeed, weren't we? We were due to have about 200 delegates from around the world converging in the wonderful Royal Botanic Garden, Edinburgh, to develop an action plan for biodiversity, really tackling the climate emergency and the nature crisis that we face at the moment. And we lined up a whole range of events at the Zoo, Museum, Dynamic Earth, the wonderful Seabird Centre at North Berwick, the Dick Vet School, and we were going to have a series of showcase presentations, which you two were going to host, and then COVID hit us. And we thought...
So why do we need a declaration like this, Des?
Well, the issue here is that we have lots of international sort of agreements in place, but locally, for local governments, for cities, for local businesses, there isn't really a rallying organisation around which they can put their efforts. And of course, if we're going to save nature, we've really got to work locally. So we worked under the auspices of the Convention of Biological Diversity and put on a virtual event to pool local governments and subnational countries like Wales and Scotland together to work up an Edinburgh Declaration, essentially a call to arms to strive to help nature. And it was an extraordinary event. I mean, we tackled this with some trepidation at first, holding this whole thing by Zoom. You can imagine, you know, just how challenging that was.
Yeah.
But in the end, as we moved into early May, we formed virtual hubs in Europe, North America, Africa, South America, Asia and the Pacific, and actually we got 400 delegates to participate in this event. So we had these online negotiations chaired, I have to say, superbly by Sir Ian Boyd, recently retired chief scientist with DEFRA, and supported by some amazing Scottish government officials. And we were able to arrive at this Edinburgh Declaration, which was published on Monday.
If this is not a stupid question, Des, I mean, this is an international effort. Why Scotland?
Why Scotland? Because we punch way above our weight. We of course, wanted to host this event. We're hosting the climate summit, the COP26, now to be held in November next year. And so we felt it was highly appropriate that Scotland should also do its bit for nature, for biodiversity as well. And you've been to the Royal Botanic Garden, Edinburgh. It's a superb location for an international event such as this. But moving this online, to have this virtual event, was a whopping great challenge. But to have 400 delegates participating throughout the world, and to have this document, which has, and I'll just quote one sentence from it, that we shall take strong and bold actions to bring about transformative change. That's what we need.
Yeah, but Jason, I admire the ambition, but what can we do? You know, what practical things can happen, especially at a local level?
So let's just think about some of the sort of nature-based solutions we talk about now. Work we do to restore peatlands, to make the coast more resilient to flooding, woodland restoration and regeneration, the urban greening projects. All of these require millions of pounds of investment, are creating lots of jobs, and goodness knows it's green economy jobs we need to create at the moment. But that work only happens locally. It happens in national parks, it happens with the support of local authorities and local communities, and most importantly, local businesses and the many NGOs that we have throughout the country with a fantastic workforce.
How about, is the political drive here in Scotland to actually do it? And the reason I'm asking that, obviously, is things like the Weretary Report, which made recommendations, but kind of put it on the shelf for 5 years, essentially. You've got the situation with things like beavers, where there's still licences being issued willy-nilly for those being shot in Tayside and things. So, you know, on the face of it, you know, we're saying the right things, but are we doing the right things?
Yes, we are, Mark. You know, and these things you're pointing to, you know, the Weretary report, Alan Weretary's report, we'll have a response to that in the autumn. Beavers, you know, there's a long haul here, but I can assure you that we're going to have beavers very well established in Scotland eventually. It's just very challenging at the moment. But, you know, earlier this week, Programme for Government came out from the Scottish Government, and very significant sums of money being announced, you know, an extra £250 million for peatland restoration, an extra £100 million for woodland restoration. I mean, that's putting your money where the action is needed. And as I say, all of this will only work if we operate locally, at the local community level.
Sandy Bremner on earlier on, saying that some legislation needs to be tweaked to get trees planted to protect salmon, not for commercial gain, just because they're trees. Do we need to just be a bit more grown up about our legislation?
I think it's not so much grown up, Ewan, it's just working appropriately with the legislation. I mean, sometimes I think we lack a can-do approach to managing nature. You know, we just need to be, you know, as it says in the Edinburgh Declaration, a bit bolder, just get on with this. If we've learnt one thing from this COVID pandemic, this awful pandemic, which I have to say you have covered superbly, you've been really inspirational in the way you've covered the joy and benefits of being outdoors. We've got to be more resilient. You know, that's what's so important. We need environmental, social and economic resilience. And that really means we have to be transformative in how we work with the environment and try to sustain nature and ourselves.
Des, as ever, it's a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Great to be in touch with you. All the best.
No problem. Take care of yourself.
Right.
Professor Des Thompson there. Yeah, again, it's there's the money there, there's the drive there, but, you know, it's joining everything up. And as Des says, a lot of this is just going to take time, but people are getting impatient.
Yeah, well, we're going to hear a bit later on in the programme about work with beavers. And, you know, it is getting higher up the political agenda, and once it's high on the agenda, then that's when changes will happen.
Anyway, this is a time of year that I actually quite enjoy. There's a tinge of sadness to it because, you know, summer's disappearing and we're definitely sort of heading into autumn and then into winter. But there's, you know, there's a vast array of colour on display at the moment. It's a very, very busy time in the countryside. I just took a walk the other day and here's some of my observations. The view from the hill up behind my house is of a checkerboard landscape. Big blocks of colour. This is rural Aberdeenshire, big sky country, so what I'm looking at here is the result of centuries of hard work and effort, cultivation. There are hundreds of acres of oats out there at the moment, field after field of skyey green second crop silage. And barley, that field to my left there, is just about ready to combine, It's the colour of lion pelt. The heads of the barley are well over, bowed in submission to the nuts of Grim Reaper. The loon hasn't got time to be grim. He's usually got a tractor steering wheel in one hand, a mobile phone in the other, and both eyes on the weather. On the right kind of day, you can stand here and watch the clouds emptying down onto the Eithen Valley. Great grey sponges wrung out by the rising land underneath. Tons of water pouring down onto these crops is very welcome in the springtime, not so welcome just now. You want it dry at harvest time. Cloud shadows crawl across this landscape, pointing out the folds in the land, the hollows, the ridges, high points, hidden places. A long time ago, a massive weight of ice ground out this land, but it takes something as insubstantial as sun and cloud to reveal it. This land is divided, delineated by dry stained dikes. Originally meant to keep beasts in, but they're also covered walkways for mice and voles, stoats and weasels, creatures small and lithe enough to eel their way through all those nooks and crannies. In other fields, the dikes have been taken away and they're separated now by fences, 3-inch wooden posts set 10 or 12 feet apart, strung with strands of high tensile wire ratcheted tight like guitar strings, just waiting for the fingers of the wind. Sometimes the top strand of the fence is barbed wire, pikey wire, vicious stuff that claws and tears at us. But young heifers stand and scratch their soft necks in it, leaving behind great tufts of hair, and yet I have never seen one bleed. It's a bit of a mystery. And everywhere out there are ditches. They're mostly out of sight, literally, beneath notice. Nowadays, they're kept clean and running by mechanical diggers, but originally, they were all dug out by hand, one spadeful at a time. It was back-breaking work done by quiet men, too thrawn to stop, but clever enough to see where the water wanted to go. They were just giving it a wee helping hand on its way. In this part of Aberdeenshire, trees are a relative rarity. They crowd onto low hilltops, refugees from the rising flood of agriculture. You find them in incongruous blocks, exclamation marks of blue-green conifers, mostly acting as windbreaks for beasts, sheltering them from the cold blast. It's busy here just now. There's tractors everywhere. The bright yellow of combines, red, blue, green. They combine, they bale, carry away, plough up, sow next year's seed, harrow and roll, and then they drive on to other fields, other crops, other clients to do it all again, because it's a rare farmer nowadays that only works for themselves. Family ties, relationships are written right across this landscape, because Abdi kens Abdi else. When the soil here is newly ploughed, like that field down there, it's a rich, russet brown. But let the wind at it and it lightens, the surface dries out, it turns plum coloured, then tan. And you can see where the old clay drains lie. It's an effective X-ray of the landscape, a bit like faint marks in an old manuscript. One splash of rain and they disappear. In the corners of the fields, you find the rusty red of dead dockings heavy with seeds, white tufts of thistle heads, fairy parachutes, chrome yellow ragwort, hot pink rose bay willow herb, scarlet haws, the purple of knapweed. Colours that vibrate and startle near to hand, and yet they just disappear at a distance. They melt into all that green and brown. So it's a patchwork quilt,
but it's three-dimensional. It's got some height to it too, much of it man-made. Wind turbines. I can stand here and count over 70 of them. Up to the north there is the power station chimney at Bodham. Over to the west, the red lights of the TV transmitter mast high above Follerue. Nearer to hand, half hidden by trees, the prop of Icy. And I used to be able to see the white horse carved into the hill below the Cold War listening station near Stricken. But that war fizzled out long ago, and the horse disappeared under a blanket of gorse. Must be about 10 years past. So this landscape is the work of many hands, many generations. A patchwork quilt, maybe, but to me it's home. I like it here. It's well tended. It's productive. It's easy on the eye. I feel lucky to be part of this. Music there from Aberdeenshire fiddler Paul Anderson. The piece is called The Rose of Glendavin from Paul's High Summit album, which, appropriately enough, was inspired by the folk and landscape of his native Aberdeenshire. I love watching Paul play. I mean, you know what he's like, Ewan. I mean, he's built like a tank, but he plays with such delicacy and such subtlety. It's beautiful.
It was interesting, Mark. I was just listening to Paul playing there, and it took me back to Portsoy Boat Festival where he was performing, and that big, big guy and that power coming from the music. It was such a beautiful, elegant touch, and it just fits beautifully in this landscape. I'm just looking around the big skies of Buchan, and it's just gold everywhere. It's just, and the robins are establishing territories. It's just a great time of year to be in this part of the world.
Yeah, exactly. Just appreciate what we've got. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElrath. If you miss any of this, think black burning shame. But there are a few ways of listening again.
We will put you on the naughty step, or you can catch up whatever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or download the Free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. We like hearing when you listen. Email us your stories at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Jean Robbins did. She said, I listened to your podcast in central Texas, just south of Austin. After you all talked with Leonie Charlton and Philip Marsden, I ordered their books. I'm reading that. That's what she's written. I've just finished Marum, which is an awesome read, and I've just begun reading The Summer Isles. Since I visited Ireland and the Dingle Peninsula last year, I am savouring the book.
I visited Scotland 3 years ago, and so I'm anxious to return. I love the podcasts. They're one of the highlights of this Texans Week. Keep up the excellent work, especially those outstanding authors.
Coming up on Out of Doors, the beauty of our ever-changing countryside, and we will reveal this week's mystery bird. But still, let's just hear it one more time. Just love the way it echoes in the landscape.
So if you think, you know, I just love that. It's like, kind of like, it's up there with curlews, isn't it? It's really evocative, and they were absent for 400 years, but as I said before, they're establishing a toehold in the northeast of Scotland. But if you know what that is, email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk and give Lewis a call, because he's absolutely inundated. His fingers are flashing all over the keyboards. 0808 592 95 00.
Earlier this week, the Scottish Wildlife Trust and the Royal Zoological Society of Scotland, along with the Mammal Society, asked folk to get involved with beaver conservation by reporting the signs of beavers that they see around the country through a Mammal Mapper app. Well done me for getting that right. To tell us more, we're joined by Dr. Helen Taylor, Conservation Programme Manager with the Royal Zoological Society of Scotland. Good morning, Helen.
Morning, guys. How are you doing?
Not bad at all, thanks. Not bad at all. Now, it's not entirely... It's not impossible to spot an actual beaver, but what kind of signs do they leave that might be easier to map?
Yeah, so beavers themselves can be quite tricky to see unless you're out around sort of dawn or dusk, but they are not subtle animals. And so the kind of things that we look for when we're going to go and survey beavers in our site over in Knapdale are things like where they've been feeding and cutting down trees. So you might see some bright orange wood that really stands out where they've stripped bark off of the tree, because they love a bit of bark. you might find twigs that look kind of anemic because they've had all of the bark taken off them. They might be in a big pile. So those are the kind of feeding signs we might see, because remember, beavers are strictly herbivores. They just eat plants, so you get lots of little woody feeding signs around the place. But then there's the bigger structures like the dams and the lodges that you might see, you know, crossing waterways. So obviously a dam is where a beaver has constructed a big pile of twigs and sticks and mud to control the waterway around it, because they like to have the water where they want to have it. And a lodge is another big pile of sticks and mud, where the beaver has built that to live in with its kits, especially over winter.
And the thing that does it for me is you see these little stumps of trees, the remains of trees, they've got a real chisel mark right across the grain. I mean, nothing else makes that kind of effect. But why do you want this information?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right about that, that characteristic sort of pencil end shape. And you could even see the teeth marks that they've put in there. But the reason to look out for this stuff and to ask people to help us look out for this stuff is because obviously beavers are spreading across from the east to the west of the country. And really, we want to be able to track that spread. And often someone who's out walking their dog or out for a run might be one of the first people to notice beaver signs in their area if there's a new beaver popped up. And so them tracking these signs using the Mammal Mapper app is actually a really helpful way for us to understand where beavers are moving around the country.
Beavers in Knapdale were released with official sanction, and then there was a whole heap of them in Teesside that were unofficial. Where else are they being found at the moment?
So they've spread across from Tayside as far. I mean, we have a beaver in Loch Lomond who's hanging out. As far as we know, they're by themselves at the moment, just waiting for some mates. They've gone right across into Comrie, Creef, throughout most of the Tay catchment. I mean, the Tay catchment has so many tributaries. It's an amazing waterway, and it's basically a super highway for beavers. They've also started to come into the Forth catchment as well, because they can get across from there. So they are sort of spreading across the country from Tayside, and eventually it would be wonderful if they would come across to the Knapdale population in Argyll and meet up with that population, because that population was designed so that the beavers could not expand, could not get out of there, because it was a trial. It was meant to see how beavers would do if we put them into the Scottish landscape without them being able to spread around.
But if they can't get out, how can the other ones get in?
Well, they might need a little bit of help for this. If they can get far enough. And it really does depend on what the Scottish Government decide around translocation of beavers as well.
So does that mean we're going to see many more of them in Scotland? Maybe possibly Aberdeenshire or the Highlands?
It's possible. I mean, you know, if you look at how they've spread, so I think the unauthorised release of beavers, the accidental escape of beavers into Tayside was around 2006. They were first clocked there. So that's about 14 years for them to sort of spread as far west as they have. So it's not like super, super rapid. In terms of rodents, beavers actually don't reproduce as quickly as things like rice, mice and rats, things like that. So they're not going to, you know, just go absolutely bananas. But they have spread. They definitely have spread. And at the moment, natural spread is the way for them to get through Scotland. But it, you know, for us, it would be wonderful to be able to secure the future of beavers in Scotland. And having people track that and understand where they are is a really great way for people to get involved with beaver conservation in this country.
So how does the app actually work?
So what you do is very simple. You download the app onto your phone, as you would with any other app. And the app tracks your walk, so it's also like a little fitness tracker if you want to see where you've walked and where you've been. And then if you stop, if you see a beaver sign or even a beaver, then you can stop. You pop a little log into the app, pop a little point where you are. It has a GPS function, so it knows where you are on your route. And then you just log what you've seen. So you're like, okay, I've seen a feeding sign, or I've seen a dam, or I've seen a beaver. If you can, you take a picture and put that on there with it, and then you send it off to Mammal Mapper. And so that data is then verified by an expert, and it gets fed into the Mammal Mapper database, which also feeds into the National Biodiversity Network and the Biological Records Office. So, Biological Records Centre, sorry. So this is, you know, this is real scientific data that will really be used. So it's an amazing way for people to get involved with proper conservation science.
It sounds like a really good idea, Helen, but, you know, just one last question before I let you go. Do you genuinely believe that the release of beaver into Tayside was accidental?
We call it an unauthorised release. So whether it was accidental or not is kind of by the by at this point. It was not a regulated release, and we are dealing with the ramifications of that now, as you can see. And that's why having projects like the Knapdale trial, which was fully licensed, fully consulted with stakeholders, is such an important way to do translocations. You know, translocations have to be done in line with regulations, in line with consultation. They affect a lot of people. And I think if you look at the difference between Knapdale and Tayside, that's a clear indication of why that's so important.
Yeah. Helen, thanks very much for speaking to us this morning.
Thanks very much for having me.
No problem. Dr. Helen Taylor there. Thank you very much. And you can find a link to the app on our website. Yeah, it's an interesting one, that.
It's interesting, the mark, isn't it? I mean, there's going to be farmers and foresters shouting at the radio at the moment, and there are problems, and, you know, there's a lot of things being put in place, but it'd just be lovely to see one of an evening, certainly in my part of Aberdeenshire. I think just fantastic animals.
Yeah, fantastic. Right, we were talking earlier about the cranes.
Ah!
I was just about to say what it was anyway. It doesn't even make any particular difference anyway. But I didn't mean to do that. There's some team folk got
what's
it right.
What's the mystery bird this week, Mark?
I don't know. Might it be a crane? Marlies McLean from Eaglesham says cranes were just returned recently to Scotland. Willie the farmer near Brechin says, is the mystery bird a crane? Because I have a friend in Wisconsin, I'm going to see the sandhill crane. I think that's what the first lot was.
He's correct.
He is correct. David Long says it's common crane.
Sandhill crane.
Yeah. David Long says, we'd once had two flying over here near Lauder on the borders. Beautiful birds. What a thrill. Charlie Leggett and Daviot says, it's a crane. Where's that one? Margaret Huntley, crane, very uplifting. Ha-ha. And Jim Fairley says, is it a pair of cranes? So, yes, absolutely, it is a pair of cranes.
Gordon Brown got in touch. He got it right. Davy and Sky got it right. George and Inverurie got it right. And Lynn and Fife got it right as well.
Excellent. So, shall we hear more about them?
The crane is like no other bird on the planet. A bird which has lived hand in hand with mankind since the dawn of creation. A bird celebrated in dance, from the crane dancers of Japan to the plate-smashing dancers of Greece. This is an incredible bird which until the 1600s roamed our wetlands and is now regaining a foothold in the northeast of Scotland. They look a bit like a heron, but they're no relation. It's the tallest bird in the UK and, in fact, in the world, with some reaching just under 6 feet tall. They can fly over Mount Everest and are found in every continent of the world, with the exception of South America. They mate for life and live for up to 60 years, and their young stay with the parents till their teens. The crane and humans are very close. And they're loud, with many species evolving the windpipe fusing into the bones of the sternum to amplify the call, which can be heard for miles. And much to the misfortune, they're very good to eat. Cranes were once widespread in Britain and were a favourite dish at medieval feasts. Over 100 cranes were served at Henry II's Christmas feast in 1251. But that popularity with hunters and the decline in wetland habitat meant their extinction from the UK in around 1600. But that is changing, with a few arriving in Norfolk in the 70s, and then in 2012, they were recorded breeding in Aberdeenshire. Now, that's all great, but what makes cranes so special is the mythology that has grown around this bird. In Greece, Pliny the Elder noted that one crane would be employed on sentry duty, allowing the others to sleep. And the selected crane would hold a stone in one of its claws, and if the crane fell asleep, the stone would fall, allowing the bird to awaken. And then there's a story that crops up in almost every culture around the world in slightly different forms, from Native Americans to Asia and throughout Europe. But the basic plot is that a man saves a crane that had been injured by hunters. And that night, a beautiful girl appears at the man's door and becomes his wife.
The man tells her he's not wealthy enough to support them, but she tells him that she has a bag of rice that will fill their stomachs. Every day the rice never goes down in the sack, and it always stays full. The next day, she tells the man she's going into a room to make something, and that he mustn't come in until she's finished. 7 days have passed, and she finally emerges with a beautiful piece of clothing, but she's very skinny. She tells the man to go to the market and sell the garment for a large price. He comes home with a pile of money, and after that they are now wealthy. The wife then goes back into the room, telling him once again not to come in until she's finished. The man's curiosity takes over, and he looks in, and then realises that the woman is the crane they had saved. And to make money, the crane wife plucks her own feathers to weave a silk brocade, which the man sells. But she becomes increasingly ill as she does so. And when the man discovers his wife's true identity and the nature of her illness, he demands her to stop. And she responds that she's been doing it for love for both of them, and then flies off to heaven. But the most striking things about cranes is their dance. Cranes are perhaps the best choreographers in the bird kingdom. Their dancing is the most ornate and intricate of all the birds. And it seems that dancing in elaborate courtship plays a really important part in crane culture. In fact, the dancing seems to be infectious. Once one begins to dance, everybody else joins in. Cranes even use props while doing the elaborate dance. They pick up bits of turf and stone and wood and toss them into the air while leaping high off the ground and bugling long and loud. It's truly amazing. And that dance is thought to have been the origin of the Greek plate-breaking dance, which is such a feature of social gatherings. Arms stretched out like wings, and in place of turf, plates are thrown into the air. Meanwhile, in Japan, twice a year, an elegant dance is performed with participants wearing spectacular wings and long, curved headgear to represent the birds. And they sway around each other in an elaborate courtship. But finally, cranes have a unique gift for mankind. According to Japanese tradition, folding 1,000 paper cranes gives you the chance to make one special wish come true. Now, the 1,000 origami cranes may be a Japanese tradition, but it was popularised and spread throughout the world through the story of Sadako Sasaki. Sasaki was a Japanese girl that suffered radiation poisoning at the age of 2 when the atomic bomb was dropped at Hiroshima during World War II. She developed leukemia at the age of 12, and inspired by the legend, she began folding cranes. She completed 644, but sadly was too ill to finish. She died that year. And Sasaki is remembered today as a worldwide symbol of the innocent children impacted by war. The crane, a special, special bird.
I was trying to remember where I was. It was in a cottage in Rackwick Bay, I think, on Hoy. And it's like a boffy. And somebody had been basically folding those little cranes and had suspended them in the window. And you're right. It's a beautiful sort of memento mori, essentially.
It's an incredible bird. But I first saw them at Findhorn, and I've seen them up at Loch Strathbeg. So it looks like they're making a comeback. But fantastic sound.
Excellent. Sadly, that's it for this week. Please don't forget to download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from noon today. But there's also the Midweek Scotland podcast, which is the second part of a chat that we had with Corinne Polworth, who's a singer and a poet and a theatre maker, etc. It was absolutely fascinating. Her connections with the land are really, really strong. Anyway, from all the team here at BBC Aberdeen, myself, Mark Stephen, him, you, and Michael Ruth, and everybody else behind the scenes, thanks for listening.